Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, motherfucker. The mortal technique. Harlem. Flashing heights, nigga. Depending on the fucking boss, the only unsigned nigga with a cold of gold in the sword. The hood is not stupid, we know the mathematics. I make double what I would, going gold or athletic. With EMI, Sony, BMG in the scope. Would never sign a rapper with the White House in the scope. They push pop music like a religion. Anorexic, celebrity driven, fighting for fantasy fiction. Contradiction of the life we was given. Life in prison, spent time with Manuel Noriega, the real Noriega, who did America 100 favors with concerts to shy the CIA, moving Escobar's coke through the MIA, we seek the third world speaking through a dead man talking, and everybody talking about the South taking over, it's a true motherfucker, but it's coming over the border, fuck your chain, my people will kill you for water, fuck chains. I got soldiers supporting. That I cut your throat if you check with a tape recorder. That's right, motherfucker. Welcome to the new world order, where the truth is always censored by corporate reporters. The government runs a drug politics in the corner. That's why I never stress rappers and their employers. I put a bag over his fucking head and torture your lawyer. Cause it's too simple to shoot you. I'll taser the roof for your mouth or the electrocute you. I'll boot you out with the food of the German Luger U-boat and the troops in the school. But nigga, you can't overthrow me like the island of Cuba. Niggas will never find your body like the bitch in a Uber. And I'll maneuver through the State Department. Men and their friends with secret deals like the Nazis and IBM. And now you know this ain't a trend or a fashion. My life and my passion. Fuck for the cash, and nigga, I need more than advancements in a rented mansion. So why you little house niggas are singing and dancing? I'll kill you and take your land like an Israeli expansion.
You're all fired up, but that's gonna cut out.
This is Rabble Rousey Rich Bertram.
And this is your boy, the icon. It's the Tornado, Tony Pennycow.
Okay, and we have a great show tonight. Even though we have.
It's just me and you, isn't it?
Yes.
That's what makes it great.
We are going.
Nobody can steal our mojo.
Right.
Right.
Last week, we just couldn't even stay on the same subject with our guest anyway. We might as well take a week off from interviews, even though we will feature one of our podcasts at the end of the show about a director of a very big movie for the troops that I did on my off time from the show. And it's not really combat sports, but it is combat related. So we're
that's real cool.
Flipping real time for me on the conference call this week with the Strike Force folks. Gina Carano has pulled out of her latest fight, and it sounds like there's a little bit of controversy. Of course, we don't know why. There hasn't been any report that says exactly why. Scott Coker's been getting himself in a little trouble lately for opening his mouth and saying stuff about what's going on and not really seeming to know the real facts. He had put out word that there was going to be a certain catch weight for the Fedor Emelianenko and Dan Henderson fight. And Henderson had agreed to go up to heavyweight, but apparently he's out there saying now that he had not agreed to any catch weight of 225 or something like that. So there's anger swirling around that. But the Gina Carano situation happened, and Scott Coker came out on the conference call. It's right there on the podcast for anyone who wants to listen. And he said that Gina Carano didn't clear the commission, which now we find out that might not be true. Now it was her personal doctor who wouldn't clear her for the fight. And she's not talking. She doesn't want to tell anybody what's going on. So I don't know whether it's because she's pregnant, which a lot of people would theorize, but it has to be something that only her personal doctor would know about. And the commission didn't catch, so I don't know, because we actually did have one of her previous opponents had to back out because she turned out to be pregnant. We talked about that on a previous show, so it could be that, but I don't know. I put a little post on SureDog saying start the rumor mill churning. We'll see what happens. And in boxing news, we had a big story. We had Floyd Mayweather finally decide to come out of retirement. Even though he wasn't formally retired again, he decided to fight again. He's going to fight Vicious Vic Ortiz. What do you think about that matchup, Tony?
Here's what I think about it. At 100% versus 100%, it's a mismatch. It'll be kind of reminiscent of when Mayweather fought Arturo Gatti. I really see it being that one-sided. Ortiz is too easy to hit. His skin is very frail. But he is a big guy. He is a strong guy. He is very physical. He hits hard. And, I'm watching a baseball game. They're having like a monsoon on the field. If Mayweather is starting to decline, which is hard to tell because, I mean, we haven't seen him in 16 months. And here's the potential, situation there is, okay, Mayweather comes back and he's not the Floyd of old. He's an old Floyd. Well, guess what? That could spell trouble for Floyd Mayweather. We saw that fight in 2010 with Shane Mosley, and it was relatively one-sided from the third round on. But in that second round, when Mosley cracked him, Mayweather really he didn't take it all that well. Now we're talking about a big guy, a big welterweight here in Victor Ortiz that can certainly, punch. So it'll be interesting to see. I'll leave it at that. Who am I picking in the fight? Well, obviously right now, smart money goes on Floyd Mayweather. He's undefeated. He's a class above Victor Ortiz, prime for prime. But if he becomes an old Floyd Mayweather as opposed to the old Floyd Mayweather, he's going to run into some trouble.
Well, it's going to be a big fight either way. It's going to be September 17th at Cowboys Stadium. And there's going to be a little bit of a different factor to this one. There's going to be a little hometown flavor for me, because the Brockton factor is going to be in Victor Ortiz's corner. He's actually training with some cousins of Rocky Marciano.
Oh,
so,
shit, huh?
Just actually figuring that out now, because there's a link in one of my boxing links that I put up today. But these guys I know pretty well. I've met them in person, the Capiello brothers, and written a little bit about them when I was in the Brockton area right next door. And
how are they associated with Marciano?
I think they're like second cousins. I don't know. Dennis was always trying to get us to have their father on the show because he actually ran around with Rocky and they hung out when they were kids and they were real close. Their families were close. And they look like fighters. They both actually fought a little bit amateur-wise. I think actually Mike Capiello was a professional for a little while, who was the better of the two brothers, but now they coach. One's a trainer, one's a promoter. Richie's the promoter, and Mike's the trainer. And they do a good job, and Victor is training with them right at their gym in Brockton. So it should be interesting to see.
Well, I'll tell you
how he does.
I'll tell you an opinion that I got the other day that really shows that people are getting off the Floyd Mayweather bandwagon. I know a lot of guys that I have a guy that's from my old gym that is such a Floyd lover and a Manny hater that he will never admit anything. Floyd is a god. Floyd can do no wrong. Manny's a cheater. Manny's a bum. You know, this and that, this and that. But I have other black folks now that are saying that Floyd's ducking Manny. So when you got your own people going against you, you know you got a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll ever come to terms. Like I've mentioned before multiple times, the lawsuit has a lot bigger impact on this than anybody might realize. There's also obviously Floyd's undefeated record. He makes more money, I think, by staying undefeated. You know, no matter who he fights.
Right, exactly.
Defeated. So.
I said it on the show. I said it when we talked to John Scully. I said it, when we talked in the past. A one would look real ugly for him.
Right. But at the same time, you know, Manny doesn't have any great reason to jump in the ring with him either. And I've said it probably way back when we first began talking about this whole thing. What happens after this fight? If it doesn't end up being that big spectacular event that everybody's been hoping for, you know. So I think the anticipation alone helps just keep people interested, you know, even though they're eventually get tired of talking about it.
Do you remember when De La Hoya fought Trinidad back in 99?
Jesus, I don't even know if I was that big of a fan back then that I was watching a lot of the lower weight classes. I think back then I was just watching the heavyweights.
Well, I'll give you a brief history. It was going to be the fight. And these guys were both undefeated. They both had zeros on their records. And there was a lot of talk about it, a lot of hype about it. And, you know, the magazines were predicting winners. And there was a lot of hype. I remember we had a party at my house with about 20-some people. They were all crammed into my living room to watch it. And the fight sucked. I mean, I still think to this day, De La Hoya got robbed. I had him winning the first 8 rounds easily. But Trinidad was stalking him. De La Hoya was hitting him. Then De La Hoya felt, you know, shit, I'm up. I'm ahead on the cards. Trinidad hit him after the bell in like the 7th or 8th round. And De La Hoya was like, shit, that kind of hurt. I'm afraid now. I'm just going to, you know, get on my tickle. I got this fight won. And I don't think he threw a punch for the last 3 rounds. I literally do not think he threw a punch for the last 9 minutes of that fight. And that's all everybody ever talks about anymore was how the fight sucked and how De La Hoya gave it away. I still think he won, to be honest, but he ended up losing the decision.
Well, actually, I'm reading this story about the Ortiz fight, and they have a quote in here from our boy that we had on here, Pit Perrin, the guy that we tried to have on, and we ended up getting him while he was bartending first. The other guy on. Now I'm forgetting the other guy's name. But anyway, Pitt told us a story about the fight over in England where bottles thrown at him and Bailey got
that Hagler fight? That was Prince Allen, I believe.
Right. So that was an interesting story. But he says, go away, Floyd. you don't want to fight. And I think I might have spoke too soon by saying that Ortiz is training in Brockton. I guess that's the part of the story that says he's working with Mike and Rich Caffeo. This is just an article on boxing, I guess, and I mentioned that. I thought it was in the vein of him working in Brockton, but I guess Victor Ortiz is not working in Brockton, but people in Brockton are talking about this fight, of course, because it's such a boxing hotbed. But on another note, speaking of one of the camps there, Golden Boy, involved in the Mayweather and Pacquiao negotiations, they just added a new guy in Luis Collazo, who's kind of on a comeback trail himself. He's a 31-4 with 16 KOs, 30 years old, and he's a southpaw from Brooklyn, New York. He's been inactive because he was waiting for his promotional agreement with I don't want to fight for him anymore. And he ended up with Golden Boy, which is a good place to end up. Richard Schaefer over there says he's a talented former world champion who has fought some of boxing's best and is eager to regain his crown. We'll make sure he gets every opportunity to shine in the coming years. And Collazo last won a title when he beat Jose Antonio Rivera in Rivera's hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts in 2005. And then he stopped Miguel Angel Gonzalez in the eighth round of his first defense, and next fight lost the belt to Ricky Hatton on a controversial decision in Boston.
That was a bullshit decision. He kicked the crap out of Hatton.
And then two fights later, he injured his hand early in the fight and lost a lopsided decision to Shane Mosley in 2007. And there's been a little post-fight news about that Mosley fight. Apparently, I don't know if we talked about this earlier, but Mosley had, at one point, tried to quit. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, they showed a little clip on of the fight on one of the HBO shows, or the Showtime shows, whatever it was. And Mosley tried to quit the fight, and his trainer had to talk him back into it.
What round was it?
I think it was in the later rounds. I'm not exactly sure. It was on the blog at least a week ago now. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I never knew that.
Yeah, I just heard about it not too long ago.
And I guess this is when, you know, things are really going out of his way.
Yeah. And we have, of course, some sad news. We had a death in the ranks of boxing. Gennaro Hernandez died of cancer. The guy that your buddy wrote about wrote about a fighter dedicating his fight to him. And he died like just yet. 45 years of cancer. He's from Mission Viejo, California. Died on Tuesday.
I remember, of course I remember Gennaro during his career. You know, tall, lanky, thin fighter, very highly skilled. He's obviously most well-known for, he had a fight with Oscar De La Hoya, which, you know, he was defeated. And then he was also, the fighter that Floyd Mayweather Jr. beat for his first world title back in 1998. And I remember when they were getting ready for that fight, and a lot of people were saying that it was too young, too soon for a Floyd. You know, they were picking Hernandez to beat him. And obviously Floyd, stopped him. But Gennaro Hernandez was a very classy guy. He was always very much a gentleman. Obviously a top quality fighter. And I remember Ring Magazine just about a year or so ago that he was stricken with cancer and that the outcome was grim. You're right, that is very threatening.
Yeah, and I have the, you know, great. So, family with that worked that out the gone. So that was very unfortunate. Not kind of. So are we good? Fought hard, just like you did in real life.
Oh, absolutely. And also, I got some news out of Philadelphia today. The Philadelphia's most decorated amateur fighters, the Allen twins, they're actually the sons of the twin sons of Nazim Richardson, Bernard Hopkins, and Shane McTrainer were involved in a car accident last night. They were both well known. I remember watching them at a show about 16 years ago when they were about 12 or 13 years old, watching these two little kids, and they were just so damn good. They had a decorated amateur career. Tiger stepped away from the sport for a while. Then he came back, was 3-0 as a pro. Rock made it to the 2004 Olympics, but he lost in the first bout of the tournament. He was about. They were both. They were in a car last night. Car accident, and Tiger was driving. Drugs or alcohol does not look to be involved. I don't know how they lost control of the car, but they hit a tree, and both are in a series right now.
Oh, were they boxers too, or just related to the game, so to speak?
Well, what did you say?
Were they both boxers?
Oh, Tiger and Rock?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Tiger was a pro at 3-0. They were two of the most decorated amateurs in Philadelphia history. And I remember when Nazim would train them when they were kids. I remember him in their corner when they were just little kids almost. And then Rock was a 2004 Olympian, and he's a pro on a Golden Boy.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, we also have some Hall of Fame news. It's Tyson going into the Hall of Fame here pretty shortly. On Sunday, he will become one of the last great heavyweights in America to go into the Hall of Fame here. Seems like he's sort of overdue, but it's good that boxing doesn't have the kind of grudges that baseball has had with controversial figures.
Yeah.
I think he had to wait less time to get reinstated as a boxer after biting Holyfield's ear off than he had to wait to get into the Hall of Fame here. But I guess that induction is going to be Sunday. So, of course, you know, we miss the Tyson in his prime. And we always have that unknown factor of what might have been if you never went to jail. Just think about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Probably spent the best time of his career in jail. And if it wasn't for jail, he was just running with the wrong crowd and getting pulled in every different direction by bad people. So he's a victim of his surroundings, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Well, here's the thing with Mike Tyson. He was becoming the man, and he had, you know, a good father figure in Customato, and he was really getting his life together. When he lost Customato and King was getting his way in there, basically they surrounded Tyson with a lot of yes men. And that's kind of why he had a falling out with Kevin Rooney, because Kevin Rooney is the only guy that would really push him. That's a good training guy, and the guy telling me how he wants to train and what he wants to do. Yeah, I mean, that's all well and good and everything, but you need a guy to be sometimes firm with you. And I don't think Aaron Snow, I don't think Richard Giacchetti, who did great with Larry Holmes, I don't think, anybody who had Tyson after Rooney really could get him to focus on that anymore. That discipline and, doing the right stuff. And basically,
Tyson surrounded by a bunker.
Yes, man, that was what it was. That was the thing. They went out there and did whatever he wanted to, and he basically just gave them money to hang around. And that was really the snuffle.
Well, we have a bunch of boxing events to talk about this weekend. We have two showbox events going on. But last Saturday, we had some good fights as well. Sebastian Zibic and Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. actually set a high mark for the HBO Boxing After Dark ratings. 1.5 million viewers tuned in to see Chavez win his first trinket, whatever that means. Zibic, I'm reading this article here. Zibic doesn't really have a name in America, and the co-feature was sort of a non-event, but it was still good for his career. And that's part of a HBO contract, I guess, that Chavez has, so he's going to be on there again, of course. Hopefully in a fight with a better-known opponent here in America. And Chavez beat out his boxing rival from Mexico, Saul Alvarez, with 1.4 million live viewers reported, but actually it ended up being $920,000. I mean, 920,000 viewers, and it somehow got fluffed in the reporting. But that's what kind of name recognition he has, I guess, at this point. A lot of people wanted to see it, and they did. Also have a pretty interesting story here. Hulk Hogan versus the Ultimate Warrior. Did you read about that? Against the Ultimate Warrior in response to a scathing online video posted by Warrior in which he accuses Hogan of drug use and having an open marriage with his first wife, Linda, among other things. In the 7-minute clip, which is a preview of Warrior's 55-minute shoot video on Hogan that is scheduled to be released on June 17th, Warrior says that Hogan is a cocaine user and a dope head. Warrior also claims that when Hogan was married to Linda, the Hulkster was agreeable to her having sex with other wrestlers and that Hogan offered her up to Warrior, who turned him down.
And yeah, I highly got that.
Yeah, right?
His wife was pretty hot.
Yeah.
Warrior wasn't turning shit down.
In an interview with TMZ, Hogan denied the allegations of drug use as well as Warrior's claims about Linda. Warrior refers to Hogan as a malicious, backstabbing operator and a liar, fraud, and phony in the video. He also criticizes Hogan for saying in an interview that the late Randy Savage was paranoid about his first wife, Elizabeth. And Warrior...
You know what the truth is? I've heard that from a number of people.
Yeah.
Disrespect to the Macho Man. He was one of my favorites. I enjoyed watching him wrestle. But a lot of rap even commented, he'd be there and in the locker room, and if somebody just said hi to his wife Elizabeth, he would like give him a look, and he'd like, almost like she was a bird in a cage, as one wrestler put it. And that's why Andre the Giant really never liked the Ultimate Warrior that much. He used to beat the shit. He didn't like the Ultimate Warrior either. He used to kick his ass. We used to kick Randy Savage's ass a lot in the ring, too.
Well, there is a 7-minute and 11-second clip here that we're actually going to post on the website by the end of the night here. So if you want to see it and hear it from the warrior's mouth, so to speak, you can later on. Some other news in mixed martial arts circles. We have a pretty interesting story. The G4 network, which is geared towards video gamers and young men. Comcast also owns it. Also owns Versus, which the UFC has another broadcast deal with. Their deal with Spike TV is running out, so lately the UFC's been kicking around different ideas. Now they're reportedly interested in acquiring a controlling stake of G4. And the only problem is it's only available in about 60 million homes across the United States. So it's not as popular as Spike, which is available pretty much on every basic cable setup in the country, as far as I know. But the problem is the UFC is looking for $325 million a year from Spike. That's up from the $170 million it's paying with the current deal, and that expires at the end of the year. And since this last year, they didn't fight to get in the house on the Ultimate Fighter, and they had a very weak crop of fighters. Actually, on the last UFC event, it was pretty disappointing to see the, like we talked about last week, some of the fighters that they threw on the card didn't look good at all from what I saw. They had Chuck O'Neill, even though he's like the hometown guy, had like just a boring one-sided fight with Chris Cope, and just wasn't entertaining at all. Didn't look like, either guy should go forward with the UFC. But Cope probably will end up with another fight, at least one other fight. But I think once he gets up to the higher caliber opponents in the UFC, he's going to have a lot of trouble, because it didn't look much different from the show. And didn't really seem to push the pace at all. He probably could have knocked him out if he had pushed it. And it was like a sparring match. It was like the guys agreed before the fight they weren't going to hurt each other. They were going to spar. It's ridiculous. But anyway, the ratings for this 13th season of Tough produced the reality show's lowest ever levels. So basically what's being theorized is the UFC is going to drop Spike. Bellator Fighting Championships, which is now airing on MTV2, would then likely move to Spike TV. So Spike obviously is probably still going to try to negotiate a better deal with the UFC if they can get it, but if they can't, they seem to have a backup plan to promote the next best fighting championship. So that will probably burn their bridge, though. If they did that, they'd never get their UFC back. And the UFC would probably be looking to sign a longer-term deal with another network if they are going to move or if they're going to acquire G4 like this article talks about here. But the G4 network is also experiencing some bad ratings. So they got work ahead of them either way. And it's 9 years old, suffered from declining ratings in recent years, and DirecTV actually pulled the channel from its lineup in November. So you can't get it on satellite TV, never mind certain cable networks. But if the UFC went on there, maybe it would be a very good investment for them, because it would generate so much of a draw. And I don't know whether it's a public company or not, but that, of course, would give a lot of people incentive if it is, because if the stock would just rise, and they could be invested. stock-wise and have a controlling interest, then, you know, that would be a good move on their parts. Let's get to the boxing schedule for this weekend. Thankfully... What?
Yeah, we got some showbox coming up, don't you? Didn't you?
Yep. Friday on Showtime, the first showbox. Tomorrow night, we're going to have cruiserweights. Prospect trained by Freddie Roach is taking a big step up. Latif KO'd, who actually we're going to try to schedule for next week. So we're going to try to get him on. I've already talked to his manager. We tried to get him tonight, but the weigh-ins are tonight, and there's a big fighter meeting and all that. So that'll be tough to do. But he's going to take on Matt Godfrey, which I don't know if you remember, but I have a sneaking suspicion we've had him on before.
I know he's one of Iceman fighters. I don't know if we've ever had him on. It's going to be a nice step up for Freddie Roach's boy. You know, you mean Godfrey's only a fight or two away from his title challenge of Marco Huck, even though he was stopped in the fifth round and lost that fight. You're still talking about a a world-ranked fighter here. So that'll be a nice little step up there. I don't remember if we've had it on. I certainly can believe if we did. With all the guys, Iceman has gotten us, during our years doing the show.
And I don't have the records right in front of me, but I'm pretty sure KO'd is like 15-0. And Godfrey has a few more fights under his belt. But also on that card, we have bantamweight Chris Avalos. And he's coming back from his first loss. He's fighting Archie Ray Marquez. Goes back after a series of shaky outings. And then also we have an ESPN card. Kenny Galarza versus Irving Garcia and Thomas Dulorme versus DeMarcus Corley on Friday. And the Galarza's last fight, he got taken to school, according to the QueensburyRules.com website here. Taken to school by Brad Solomon. The loss was a wake-up call for Galarza, who had been carried by his power in all 14 of his wins, all by knockout. And that was his first real tough defeat there. So he's fighting Garcia this time, Irving Garcia. And Garcia's a pretty tough guy himself. He was in a rock'em sock'em bout with Luis Carlos Abreu, which he lost, and has since lost to Mike Jones and Antonin Dicari. So he's in need of a comeback win as well. And then Dulorme versus DeMarcus Corley. It's a pretty good fight. And they're calling it the real show here. Must-see prospect in boxing right now is Dulorme. He's going to be taking a massive leap in competition up to Corley, who's on a slide of late, several fights in a row, giving young fighters a tough time, but he's still much better than anyone Dulorme's faced. And then one of our old friends, so to speak, I guess, even though he's a young guy, Dak Nguyen is fighting Lou Dalval this Saturday on Showtime. And Dak Nguyen, I saw when he was a young buck. He was like on his fourth fight or so in Massachusetts when I went to my first, actually, professional boxing match, I think, or my second one. It was my second one at the Roxy. And I saw him, and I had no idea who his trainer was. And I ended up going up to his trainer, who had a nice fancy pair of sunglasses on, big black guy, all kinds of jewelry. And I shook his hand. He acted like, he was something special, and I had no idea who he was. So I just kind of brushed him off and was like, ah, I want to talk to Dot. Can I get an interview with Dot? And it turns out, later on, I find out that was Buddy McGirt.
I remember you saying that.
So I was a little embarrassed, but I interviewed Dot backstage and got a really good interview out of him. It's probably still in the archive somewhere on the website. But Dot in the end's taken a real big step up. He's only got one loss on his record. With Lou Del Val is undefeated, I believe. I got to get on BoxRec here to confirm all this, but we'll get to that a little later. But Del Val is excellent competition. And he was on the undercard of Sergio Martinez versus Paul Williams 2. And he looked pretty good on that show. And it's going to be a pretty tough fight for him. And Nguyen's been kind of off the radar for a while. He hasn't fought at least a year, I think. But he's got a lot of KOs. He's a tough little brawler. I remember he was actually on an ESPN card in one of the best fights I've ever seen. And it was a guy that was on the card the same night that I saw Dat Nguyen, and I actually interviewed both of them the same night. Castulo Gonzalez, I think his name was. And it went eight or ten rounds. I forget. It's probably 8 rounds at the time. I think Castillo had a few more fights, but they were both early in their career. And it was an absolute slugfest. One of the best fights I've seen on ESPN in a while for a couple guys that weren't expected to put on that kind of a show. So I got my money on Dat to pull the upset. I'm pretty sure Dat's prepared. He's got a great trainer. And I'd love to see him beat a guy that's undefeated. Stick it to him. And then we also have Austin Trout versus David Lopez on Saturday in Monterrey, Mexico. And unfortunately, I don't have their records in front of me. But actually, Lopez is here. He's 40-12. Don't know much about Trout, but we'll get to the full records later on. I'll at least mention him as a footnote when we get on BoxRec. Just kind of run through this here real quick because it's all put together on QueensferryRules.com. We got Telefutura card headlined by some women. Boxer Holly Holm. Junior Bantamweight Omar Narvaez is going to have a title defense on the card as well. Let's just go to BoxRec. This is not even giving me the opponent for Holly Holm. Not good. We also have, of course, UFC to talk about. We had the big UFC fights this past weekend. And the main event, no surprises as far as I'm concerned. The WEC merger was kind of put front and center because we had Anthony Showtime Pettis versus Clay Guida, a UFC veteran. And Guida, who is actually ironically referred to as the UFC's version of the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got long hair, and he bounces around a lot, you know. He doesn't shake the ropes because there aren't any ropes, but...
I was just going to take the cage.
Yeah. He jumps around in the cage. Somebody actually asked him on the conference call before the event, does he get tired just coming to the ring, to the cage? And he's like, I never get tired. And he looked that way. He went to all three runs, and he didn't at all look tired. Put on a good show, and he won handily. Really, really had a good shot. And another WEC fight on the card ended up being a hometown guy that I've seen a bunch of times. Josh Grisby had a particularly rough fight against George Roop. Got his ass kicked. He started off strong, but Roop started hitting him on the side of the head with these elbows, little short elbows. It was actually Roop's plan to weather him down to the point where he was in deep water and then drown him, basically. And he did. I mean, he executed his game plan perfectly. And basically what happened at the end of the fight, I think it was like late in the third round, Grisby got hit with a vicious body shot and just went down. It was actually the first time I've ever seen a body shot result in a knockout. And the ref just waved it off because then he'd just taken such ridiculous. But Grisby actually did start out very strong with his wrestling and was looking good. Just couldn't hold on to that momentum. And as I said, the big fight there with Chris Cope and Chuck O'Neill didn't work out to be that entertaining. But the other fight, the winners of The Ultimate Fighter, the two guys that came out of the show on top, they fought for the, of course, the big, the honor of getting the contract, of course, the official contract, but I think both guys will end up with a career in the UFC. And the bragging rights, of course, of winning the whole, you know, the whole shebang, being the best of the best of The Ultimate Fighter, went to Tony Ferguson, who had just a brilliant performance there. And he had a bad reputation for all the crap that he said in the house, and he beat Ramzi Nejem. It was a little bit of a back and forth early on, but Ferguson's power is just unbelievable. He's working with Brock Camp, doing really well, and came out on top with he was a left hook, so good boxing. And just hit him right on the point of the chin, knocked him right to the ground, and that was it. That's all she wrote. But Nejem is a very good boxer. He's a very good wrestler, not as much of a boxer. So he does end up working a little bit more on his boxing and working with his shorter reach, trying to figure out how to fight better with that and move around better and avoid those kinds of shots. I think he's going to have an excellent career. And I've seen at least one writer say that he's probably going to be a champion in the future, but we'll see. He's going to have to avoid Ferguson. I don't know if he'll ever be able to beat that guy. He's just too tall and lanky, and he's got too much power. But we'll have to see. And we have the big UFC 131 this weekend. Junior Dos Santos versus Shane Carwin. We'll go over that whole card a little bit later. Computer's acting a little slow here. Trying to get the box correct. It's taking forever. Trying to think of what other fights were on this finale. Did you catch any boxing this last week, weekend?
Well, I got to watch the fights on Saturday. I didn't get to see too much of the fights on Friday, but I got to see the fights on Saturday. It was great. I had a friend of mine over, and then you know, his family, so we were all watching them together. We had the Carl Frotch, Glenn Johnson fight. Which was interesting. The first few rounds were kind of uneventful, but it was another one that, if you read what I wrote on Iceman Scully's you know, fight for him about that fight and the entire Super 6. I said, you know, it's going to be a fight. The guys are going to tag each other, and it's going to be a pretty competitive fight. But in the end, one guy is just going to be too young for the other guy. And that was Carl Froch, was just too young and had too, his legs were just too lively for Glenn Johnson. You know, I think in the prime, to be honest, Johnson takes him. Johnson's not in his prime anymore. He's a good, tough, grizzled fighter, but against very good fighters, he was still beat. Against championship caliber and elite fighters, he will just come out short. And then, of course, then we had the, you know, the HBO card. You know, of course, the Chavez-Sebastian Zivic fight. Good fight. You know, Chavez won because Zivic's not much of a puncher. If Chavez would have been in there, say, against a younger Kelly Pavlik or Sergio Martinez or even a Paul the Punisher Williams, he probably wouldn't have got out of the fifth, sixth round. Chavez is a good young fighter, but he's too easy to hit, and he is not his father. He's good. His father was great. Last weekend was the fact that he was fighting a guy that had quick hands but wasn't much of a puncher. If he would have flushed with those shots from a guy that was a puncher, it might have been a little bit different of a story.
Well, I actually did catch some of the replay that was on YouTube of that fight, and they're saying that the eighth round was fight of the year candidate type stuff, or round of the year candidate, and it did look to be pretty even at that point. Both guys throwing bombs at each other, either one backing down. Froch just had the better overall package, I think, and might be a little bit of an age factor. Obviously, Johnson's getting up there in his 40s, so couldn't have been easy. Basically, I think it was just style-wise, Froch was the more tactical fighter, and he just knew where to score points and how, and obviously it seems like Johnson got a little bit of a late start, and then Froch ended up putting that start down in the championship rounds, from what I heard. That's where he really capitalized and won the fight. But getting back to this weekend, I'm finally on Boxrec. We have a pretty interesting battle down in Argentina, worth mentioning. Vacant South American featherweight title. Carlos Ricardo Rodriguez, 24-2 with 12 knockouts, fighting Sergio Manuel Medina, 35-4 with 20 knockouts. And also the interim WBA world flyweight titles on the line between Jean Piero Perez and Juan Carlos Reviso, who's 26-1 with 15 knockouts. Perez is 18-3 with 13 knockouts, one draw. Holy crap. Another Argentina fight here. It's the only fight on the card on Friday. Miguel Angel Arroyo, 87-18 with five draws and 55 knockouts. That's pretty impressive. He's fighting Valentin Antonio Ochoa, who's 20-19, two draws, eight knockouts. Quite the record there. Now, although I've never heard of them, I don't know if those are all Argentina fights or not. How that works there. Let's see what else. Ooh, here's the mismatch of the week in Mexico. It's going to be Friday. Lizardo Moreno, who's 38-10 with 29 knockouts and two draws, is fighting Jesus Gomez. That also makes it the fight of the week and the mismatch of the week, which is probably the first time that's happened. But Jesus is going to need Jesus because his record is 0-3. He's knocked out once. fighting a guy who's 38-10, matchmaker should be fired. That's ridiculous for a main event. I don't know how they couldn't find a fighter to match up, at least, you know, with a few wins in Mexico. Come on now. Can't be that hard. That's ridiculous. Here's that card we were talking about on Telefutura. It's going to be from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Friday night. It's a light welterweight fight between Holly Holm, who's 29-1, 9 knockouts, 3 draws. She's fighting Victoria Cisneros, who's 5-11 with 2 draws. And the men's Kova feature there is going to be Elko Garcia, 24-7, 12 knockouts, middleweight, fighting Joaquin Zamora, who's 18-3 with 12 knockouts. And the Roseland Ballroom fight, Galarza, Annie Galarza, is 14-1 with all 14 knockouts, fighting Irving Garcia, who's 17-6 with 8 knockouts, 3 draws. And DeLorme on that card is 11-0 with 10 knockouts, fighting DeMarcus Corley, who's 37-17 with 22 knockouts and 1 draw.
DeMarcus, back in the day, pretty damn good. He is well past his prime. And he's taken a pretty good beating in those last fights.
All right. And Latif Kayode, he is undefeated. I gave him 15 wins, but he actually has 16. 16-0 with 14 knockouts. Godfrey is 20-2 with 10 knockouts. That fight is for the vacant NABA cruiserweight title. And the co-main event is Chris Pavlos, 18-1 with 15 knockouts at bantamweight, fighting Khabib Suleymanov, who's 11-0 with 5 knockouts. And also on that card is Archie Ray Marquez, 12-0 with 8 knockouts, fighting Art Hovhannessian. You probably butchered the crap out of that name. What can you do? Another Argentina fight here for the WBO Super Flyweight title. Omar Andres Narvaez, 34-0, 2 draws, 19 knockouts, fighting William Urena, 17-1 with 14 knockouts on Saturday in Argentina. Also, there's a light flyweight female championship fight between Jessica Yolanda Bach, who's 15-0 with 6 knockouts, fighting Yesenia Martinez Castrejon, 9-6 with 8 knockouts. They're fighting for the WBO female light flyweight title and the WBA female light flyweight title. And a couple other interesting fights on this card. Roberto Domingo Sosa is fighting a 6-rounder at super flyweight. He's 20-0 with 12 knockouts. He's fighting Santiago Ivan Acosta, who's 17-7 with 7 knockouts and 2 draws. Also at welterweight, we have Hector David Saldivia, 37-2, 30 knockouts, fighting Carmelito de Jesus, 14-2, with 11 knockouts. Let's see what else we have here. We got fighting in Bosnia this weekend. Bosnia-Herzegovina. Cruiserweight fight, the main event, Nenad Borov-Kanin, 27-0 with 19 knockouts, fighting Konstantin Samerjiev, 29-12 with 18 knockouts. No title on the line there, though. The vacant USBA light middleweight title is on the line in the Cayman Islands. It's a great place for a fight. The Cayman Bay and the Art and Recreational Center there. Charles Whitaker, light middleweight, is 36-12 with 23 knockouts, 2 draws. He's taking on David Toribio, 19-12 with 12 knockouts. And also the co-feature there is going to be a six-rounder welterweight fight between Damian Frias, 16-4 with 7 knockouts, 1 draw, fighting Alex Perez, who's 13-0 with 7 knockouts. Undefeated fighters going at each other in France on Saturday at light middleweight. For get a load of this, this is a mouthful title right here. The vacant World Boxing Federation Intercontinental Light Middleweight title. They had to think a while to come up with that one. Sebastian Madani, 30-1 with 9 knockouts, fighting Frank Mamani, 9-0. 6 knockouts. They're still undefeated. I think I said they're undefeated. Madani has 1 loss. Then we go to Hamburg, Germany, for the WBO Asia Pacific Cruiserweight title fight between Alexander Alexeyev, 20-2 with 18 knockouts, fighting Damian Norris, 16-6 with 10 knockouts on Saturday. Also, the vacant WBO European middleweight title is on the line between Gokalp Ozekler, 10-0 with 5 knockouts, and Rafael Bejaran, 12-1 with 5 knockouts. And we got from Fukuoka, Japan, we have a couple mismatches. Kazuyoshi Nikki, 26-5 with 14 knockouts, fighting Juana Padek Sith Saifong, 0-5. And the co-feature, Kenji Oba, 20-0 with 2 draws, 15 knockouts, fighting Rung Nguyen Korat Sports School. Spelled right, just like it sounds, Sports School, 0-5. 0-5 guys going against guys with over 20 wins. Obviously, it's going to be like an exhibition fight there, I think. And another fight we talked about earlier from Mexico, Austin Trout. He's 22-0 with 13 knockouts, fighting David Lopez, who I said is 40-12, but he has 23 knockouts. He's been knocked out 9 times. That's with WBO World Light Middleweight title. And another interesting female fight on that card for the WBC female super flyweight title. Ana Maria Torres, 24-3 with 3 draws and 14 knockouts, fighting Vanessa Guimaraes, who's 9-3 with 8 knockouts. And a featherweight 10-rounder between Eduardo Escobedo, 33 with 21 knockouts, fighting Mauricio Martinez, 35-11 with 23 knockouts. That's for the vacant Fedecaribe featherweight title. Let's see. We're still going here. WBO Africa title on the line. Namibia. Bethwel Ushona, 23-1 with 8 knockouts, fighting Peter Uluak. 10-3, 6 knockouts, 2 draws. IBF International Featherweight title on the line in the Philippines on Saturday. Ray Bautista, 30-2, 23 knockouts, fighting Heriberto Ruiz, who's 46-10, 28 knockouts, and 2 draws. And a few other interesting fights there. Just got to skip down on here. The International Boxing Organization middleweight title is on the line in the Ukraine between Kandil Kurtsits, who's 24-2 with 14 knockouts, fighting Dionisio Miranda, 21-6 with 18 knockouts, 2 draws. So A lot of fights this Saturday. All over the place. Haseem Rahman is fighting this Saturday in Mississippi, believe it or not.
Is he fighting a 4-rounder?
He's fighting a 10-rounder, believe it.
Wow.
49-7, 40 knockouts, 2 draws. Keelan Brown, who's 35-16, 1 draw, 22 knockouts. And it's the co-feature of a title belt, a title fight at middleweight.
I know there was a guy, Gabe Brown, that was like 348 pounds. What's Keelan Brown's record?
35-16.
Okay. Click on him for a minute and, you know, get me. I know of him.
242 pounds is what he weighed for his last fight.
All right, so he's not like Gabe Brown at 340-something. I'm trying to remember where I know him from, and hopefully it's for something good, not bad.
He last fought in April 23rd, he lost to Chauncey Weller. He's fought in the Northeast a little bit, Lincoln, Rhode Island, last year, Kansas and Missouri, Edmonton, Glendale, California. Doesn't look like he's been to Philadelphia, Tony. Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, in 2008. He had a TKO loss.
Well, Slippery Rock's closer to Pittsburgh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Your favorite town.
Good comment.
Yeah, that's the only time he's been anywhere close to you. Well, I can see. But the main event that fights for the vacant IBF International Middleweight title and the vacant WBO NABO Middleweight title, Patrick Mujewski, 16-0 with 11 knockouts, fighting Marcus Upshaw, 13-5, 1 draw, 6 knockouts. And there's the Lou Del Valle card here. Luis Orlando Del Valle, 12-0 with 10 knockouts. That is 17-1 with 6 knockouts. I did have a blog up on the website about this posting. And Del Valle is talking a lot of smack, like he's just going to ruin that. Yeah, but that has a little bit more of a little bit more experience in the ring, so hopefully that pays off for him. So I'll be rooting for him this fight. The vacant NABA middleweight title is also on that card on Showtime. Jonathan Gonzalez, 13-0 with 13 knockouts, fighting Richard Gutierrez, 26-6 with 16 knockouts. And I think that's going to be it for this weekend. Takes us through to Monday. See anything else before Thursday. Although, we'll probably know who he's fighting next week, but we have a whole one-sided card here. We're fighting TBAs, and one of them is Carlos Manuel Baldomir. Fighting Argentina next Friday. So, let's talk about that then. Next Thursday. See who he's fighting. So, like I mentioned earlier, we have UFC 131 to talk about. And I wanted to get through the Ultimate Fighter 13 official results first. We had the preliminary fights. We had Ruben Duran beat Francisco Rivera at 157 in the third round by rear naked choke. Scott Jorgensen beat Ken Stone by knockout in the first round, 4-1 mark. That was actually a pretty good fight. It was a little back and forth before the knockout. Clay Harvison, another Ultimate Fighter guy, won by split decision over Justin Edwards, who a lot of guys on the show said it was unfortunate that he lost early because he has a lot of potential. But apparently he was able to show it against Clay Harvison there. Shamar Bailey got upset by Chris Cope in the semifinal of the show. He fought Ryan McGilvery, another Ultimate Fighter guest participant there. That was also a decision, unanimous-wise. And it kind of goes to show you the level of fighters on the show, that they seemingly, all of them except for the main event guys, went to decision, even when they were on the big stage. You think you're on the big stage, you're on the fringes of either getting accepted or not ever fighting again, and you're going to want the knockout to really put the exclamation point on and solidify your spot if you're going to get one. And all these guys went to decision. But as I talked about, George Rook beat Josh Crispy at 3-14 in the third round by knockout, body punch. Jeremy Little Heaven Stevens took it to Daniel Downs, our former guest. Danny didn't do so well. I sent you that clip of him getting
pretzel.
He didn't submit. We'll give him credit for that. He had his arm wrapped around his neck there, pretty bad, up behind his back, and didn't tap. Suck it out. I don't know whether he dislocated anything, but it looked like he should have. And Jeremy Stevens won a unanimous decision. But Stevens has a lot of experience, and I think Danny Downs is still young. He's got a long road ahead to improve and keep up the good fight. Cope versus O'Neill, we already talked about. Unanimous decision for Cope. Kyle Kingsbury beat Fabio Maldonado by unanimous decision. Tim Credor, another old Ultimate Fighter alumni, had a tough loss against Ed Herman. We might not see Credor again in the cage, but you never know. He got knocked out from punches. From what I remember, when he was on the Ultimate Fighter, he was a guy who was on the comeback season of the show. He had been out of the game for a while and came back. His career dates all the way back to 2001. So he's been at it 10 years, which is pretty interesting. And he had a lot of first-round wins in his career leading up to this fight. But he lost to Nate Quarry before this, and now Ed Herman. So maybe they probably give him one last chance. Three losses in your out these days, in most cases. But he's been pretty good for the league. He performed really well on the show. He's a good character, at least. And then Clay Guida versus Anthony Pettis. That was a unanimous decision. Guida looked really good. He's asking for a title shot now. He probably will end up getting one. Then we, had Tony Ferguson versus Ramzi Najem. And it was a first-round knockout at the 354 mark of the round. And UFC 131, we have Shane Carwin versus Junior Dos Santos. And, of course, this card is because Brock Lesnar had to have 12 inches of his glute for his battle with diverticulitis. Carwin's only loss came against Brock Lesnar, who got his butt kicked in the first round of that fight. And it was really the first fight to expose Brock's lack of boxing ability. Carwin just took it to him and ended up gassing out. He had the same problem that the world's strongest man seems to keep having in his fights. All the oxygen went to his muscles. He didn't have any left for his lungs. And just went down the second round to good wrestling and got caught in what they call an arm triangle choke. Lost in the second round at the 219 mark of their fight. Now he's, this is the first fight back since then. That was in July of 2010. And this is his first fight since then. He got a shot at Junior Dos Santos. Dos Santos is also 12-1. And he's looked pretty good. His last fight was against Roy Nelson. He won by unanimous decision, showed excellent striking at UFC 117. And that was in August of last year. And his only loss was back in 2007 by armbar to a guy named Joaquim Ferreira, who I never heard of. I don't know if a lot of other people have ever heard of him, but that was actually a rematch of a fight in 2007 where he beat Joaquim by submission from exhaustion. It says right here on Sure Dogs. I've never heard of an exhaustion submission, but there we have it. This time in his career, which is probably a good move. His last fight was against Gray Maynard. He had a tough unanimous decision loss at UFC 118 back in August last year. And he had beaten Clay Guida and Takanori Gomi before that. But just seeming could never get a good title shot there. Previously. So now he's coming down in weight. Yeah, he's going to fight Diego Nunes, who's 16-1. And I don't know if I mentioned, but Kenny's record is 13-5. And of course, I'll be rooting for him because he's a Boston guy. Seen him at a lot of the shows up there. Actually, did have a YouTube interview. I thought I had, I should say, a YouTube interview, but my buddy wasn't hitting the record button when I thought I was interviewing him for the camera. So I ended up having to write it instead of actually having the footage. But I actually saw his brother's debut the same night. His younger brother got a submission win in his amateur debut there. But we have a pretty decent opponent here in Diego Nunes. His only loss was against LZ Davis back in 2009. And he's been in the WEC since 2008, and he's already had his debut in the UFC on New Year's Day this year against Mike Brown, who he beat by decision. Split decision. And Mike Brown, I have a connection to him because he graduated from Norwich. He was on the wrestling team. He might have actually been on the wrestling team the same year I was, but I don't particularly remember him offhand. And I didn't spend that much time with the team that year because I fell off a freaking roof. That's how I ended up being a boxer. Starting the boxing team. Otherwise, I might be in MMA right now. Who knows? So, there you have it for that matchup. It should be a decent fight. Both guys are very well experienced. And Kenny is probably just going to be unbelievable at this weight. He's going to have no body fat. I can't see how he could even make the weight in the first place, but he's going to have a lot of conditioning to get to that point. And I think it's going to make a lot of difference. He's going to feel like a heavier guy. And he's going to be one Dynamo versus Dave Herman. Dave Herman I actually saw way back when we pretty much were in the beginning stages of Fight News Unlimited. And I was actually flown down to Iowa for Coliseum Carnage, and that was his third fight listed on SureDog here. He's sort of a weird character. I don't know if he still is that weird, but the promoter, I remember at the time telling me that he didn't even have fight shorts for his fight. And he was living out of his car, and his nickname is Pee-wee, Dave Pee-wee Herman. And he actually, when he got time to make the post-fight commentary, he thanked a wine company and talked about eating muffins. What the hell is going on with this guy? But he beat their FSG's the Coliseum Carnage, their extreme fighting championship guy there. I forget what league it was now. But he beat their big-time hometown hero there, Greg Hammer, back in 2007, April 2007. And now he's in the UFC. And he's fought all over the place. He was in Elite XC for a couple of fights back in 2008, beat Ron Waterman and Mario Rinaldi. And he doesn't like to stay in the cage all that long, or the ring, no matter where he fights. He's got probably one of the best first round win records I've ever seen. He only has one loss, actually two losses, both in the second round. One back in 2010, May of 2010, to Ramu Chieri Sokoju by disqualification for illegal knees. And the other was TKO from punches, Mubei Choi, back in 2009. But other than that, he's had, let's count them up here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 so far first round wins, and 18 first round wins. He had his last fight for Bellator Fighting Championships last September, and his last fight was a unanimous win over Yoshihiro Nakao at SRC Seoul Fight December of last year, and that was his first win to go more than one round. Actually, his second win to go more than one round. That went three rounds. He won by unanimous decision. And actually, that was the first fight he ever finished, period. Never had finished a fight before that. He did have another third-round win back in 2008, but he knocked this guy out with knees and punches at the 33-second mark of round three. So pretty interesting career for a guy who was living out of his car.
I don't take that shit.
Fought a lot of tough guys. A lot of different leagues. Quite an interesting character. We also have Demian Maia versus Mark Munoz. Donald Cerrone versus Wagner Rocha. Chris Weidman versus Jesse Bonfelt. Eve Edwards versus Sam Stout. Dustin Poirier versus Jason Young. Nick Ring versus James Head. Nick Ring is the guy that was on The Ultimate Fighter who everybody was trying to figure out whether he's gay or not. Because he's so feminine. And he ended up busting his knee up. And he's 11-0, actually. His last fight was in February. He fought Ricky Fujita. And won by unanimous decision there on the Penn versus Fitch undercard. But he never did really get to make an appearance after The Ultimate Fighter until February. So he was out for a long time because of that knee injury. And he's just getting back into it. So, and he was the favorite to win the whole thing at that point, believe it or not. So he was a very good fighter, regardless of his flamboyance. He's fighting James Head. Should be an interesting fight. 7-1. Darren Elkins is fighting Michihiro Omagawa. Christoph Sosninski versus Mike Mesenzio, and Aaron Rosa versus Joey Beltran. All around, this is a pretty stacked card for, you know, well-rounded talents, a lot of interesting characters, a lot of tough guys, a lot of mix and match WEC and UFC guys. So, I think it'll be a good show. We'll see. And other than that, we're pretty much down to whatever other MMA shows are coming up for our news this week. Let's see. We got MFC 30 Unplugged 4 up close and personal in Edmonton, Alberta tomorrow night. Score Fighting Series in Ontario. AMMA 7 Confrontation also in Edmonton tomorrow. Cage Wars 6 from Extreme Fight Events down in Chester, Pennsylvania. Beach Brawl.
Yeah, that's another Joey I production.
Oh, really?
I get to one of his shows, but it's so hard for me in the summer because I'm working a lot of weekends, so.
Yeah, Beach Brawl at Atlantic City, New Jersey. Should be hot enough for that. I hear it's like 97, 98.
Yeah,
out there in the Northeast, having a heat wave there. Also on Friday, Mitchell Fight 5 from Power of Brazil. In the Panhandle, Amarillo versus Dallas in Amarillo, Texas on Friday. Midtown Throwdown from Eugene, Oregon. Extreme Combat International 19 from Huntsville, Alabama. Undisputed from Reno, Nevada, which I would go to if Reno, Nevada was 8 hours away. I always thought it was closer for some reason. Maybe I thought Las Vegas would be a lot smaller.
The opposite catty corner of the state. You figure, you know, Vegas is, you know, southeastern in the state, and Reno is more of the northwestern.
Right.
Something like that.
Then we got URC 25 Undisputed. Oh, I already said that. That's in Reno. That's the one in Reno. Actually, we have Nowhere to Run, CES MMA in Lincoln, Rhode Island at the Twin River Event Center. BFL 33 Thunder in the Cage from Hagerstown, Maryland. That's on Saturday. These are all on Saturday now. MMA Berlin Tournament 25 from Berlin, Germany. Bad Beat 2 from Commerce, California. Knuckle Force. A good one. From Tynemouth, England. Shooting Disco 15 in Tokyo. Pacific Extreme Combat in the Philippines. Canadian Extreme Cage Rage from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. We got Big Country versus Big City 2 in Penrose, Colorado. Mayhem in the in Mesquite, Texas. Last Man Standing 2 in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Valley Fight Series in Allentown, Pennsylvania. One Step Closer in Atlantic City. Epicenter MMA Cage Fights in Charlotte, North Carolina. Road to the Championship in Florence, Kentucky. Boys Gone Bad 3 in Asheville, Ohio. Night of the Rising Stars in Evansville, Indiana. Battle Zone 3 in Dublin, Ireland. Jackson Street Fights in Harlingen, Texas. And Provoked in Belfry High School Gymnasium in South Williamson, Kentucky. And finally on Saturday we have Proving Ground MMA Series 7 in Akron, Ohio. And also we have a few fights here on Sunday. Give me 1 second, I'll get to those. I want to load up our podcast to go out with here. All right. Sunday fights, we got SWAT VT times 4 in Tokyo, Japan. Gate Challenge 7 in Aichi, Japan. Germany versus Russia in Gießen, Germany. And that's it. Until next week. It's actually a fight next week. Fight Night 1 in Amman, Jordan. It's a new one. We're going to have Jonathan Flora finish out the show, a podcast we did last week about the Lieutenant Dan Band documentary. So till next week, we're going to sign off and leave the last half an hour to Jonathan Flora, who's a producer of a real good documentary about Gary Sinise, who started the Lieutenant Dan Band based on his character in Forrest Gump. And I interviewed him last Friday. So here we go. Talk to you next week. Thanks for stopping by. From Fight News Unlimited and MemorialsForHeroes.com, and we're on the line with Jonathan Flora, who's the executive producer of a movie called Lieutenant Dan Band. It's a tribute to the troops. And Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about the whole project itself?
Well, actually, I'm the producer and director, and the way this came about was when Gary Sinise and I became friends. I first started learning about all of the things that he did to support the military and our first responders. I actually have no idea of what he does, and that's all by design, because he certainly doesn't do it for the publicity or anything like that. And then the more I realized he was doing it, more so the impact that it had on those on the other end, meaning the troops and their families, I started talking to him about the idea of doing a documentary so that people can see what happens in using him and Dan as a vehicle to meet all these other wonderful people that are also doing things for the troops. But again, show folks what it really means to end user, which is to go out in the field or the firemen and their families. And it's just been a wonderful journey. I followed him for nearly 2 years, and it's just been an incredible experience.
Cool. And I know, Sarah, you're a veteran yourself of the 82nd Airborne Division, and I want to thank you for your service there. My father was actually in Green Beret in Vietnam with Project Delta. I'm not sure if he was 82nd or 101st, but... that's pretty impressive. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, it was pretty interesting being a veteran, too, because I was in the 82nd Airborne, as you mentioned, and also the Ohio National Guard for another 9 years after that. And it was right after that I got out that my unit actually was going over the first Gulf War. So having never seen any action, I was then not that involved in the military for quite a while. So I started getting involved in this being part of the GI Film Festival in Washington, D.C. And to be able to still find a way to serve, even while still not wearing the uniform, especially for the guys and gals that have, you know, now been basically in war for nearly 10 years, it's just an incredible honor. And of course, to go back to Fort Leonard, where we shot some of the documentary and the amazing training and recruit there, but I know I didn't look that young when I went there. So, of course, you probably prisoners, and I absolutely did. But the idea that these guys are still enlisting in a time of war, I just think that's
Life on the line, then what does that say about us as a society? And that's why
why we're also releasing it the manner that we're doing it. We're releasing it online for the first 30 days, July 4th, at ltdanbandmovie.com. And therefore, one out of every $4 that is paid for streaming is going to go back to the Guaranteed Foundation, which then goes to support the military, their families, and other organizations. What we also discovered, because we have the PSAs running that are addressing military suicide, we're getting emails from people in the field, from Afghanistan and from Iraq and from Europe. And so now we know that this way our people can also see this movies, whatever theater they may be in. So I need that occupy a location, whether it's a worship or on a post somewhere. So I agree with you, it's helping to shine a light, reflect the spotlight off of our celebrity, putting on real heroes and troops. And I think that's not very good things about our society, but we're not going to let that happen.
And throughout this whole project, what would you say was the greatest moment for you?
I think the greatest moment for me is being able to just sit on a rock somewhere with a soldier that is telling me what it means to him to be in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in a battle zone. And not just because of military successes, but because of what he saw in the eyes of the people that were there, the people that they were liberating. The women in particular, the young children in particular, trying to help people realize over there that, you know, they can actually have a business, that they can open up a shop, the things that they're allowed to do that they've never had an opportunity. And again, just being around young people that are volunteering in a time of war, there's a waiting list for Marines. There are next door neighbors that have to wait 3 months before you can even get into the Marine boot camp because of the line. And it's just been, that's the incredible part. And then, of course, the other side of that is when you met with somebody and then a matter of a few days later, you might get an email from their parents saying, hey, I understand that you just met my son and I'm wanting to let you know that he was just killed. And these families, some of the widows, they're just the most honorable people that I know, and I respect them so much. Because I know so many now that have taken a terrible moment in their life by losing a loved one. And now turned it into possibly their calling, where they can speak to other widows and spare them with some of the things that they've had to go through. They're not always misunderstood. And when I'm with a soldier, they can say, you know, it really bumps us out, and now this whole thing, they'll believe, they'll read. The only right about is if we get hurt, because they're talking to a body count as opposed to the school supply that we're taking the kids, the good that they're doing.
Right. So it's the word from the newspaper business, and that was a familiar saying. That was the big story was, if there's a fatality, that was going to make the front page. This is something that, unfortunately, the way it is, in a lot of cases. But it was a surprise, and I think a good thing, the way that they focused on the war at first in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they had reporters. They brought a lot of the footage back, I think, but then it just kind of fell off. One of the organizations just couldn't afford it anymore. They just really lost interest. But I like the fact that you talk about the ultimate sacrifice there, because the whole reason why MemorialsForHeroes.com got started was because I had a friend who was on my boxing team over Norwich University up in Vermont, who was serving in Baghdad and was killed by an IED back in 2007, in April of 2007. And I put together a plaque drive for him to get a plaque made. And they just dedicated it for Memorial Day. And his whole family was there and made the news. And it was a really great event. And the plaque came out beautiful. And his parents were so appreciative, you know, because it just seemed to them like, nobody kind of acknowledged it in the town he grew up in. Gave a big salute to him in passing. So it was the culmination of that and the experience I had through doing that project that led me to create a website that was designed to do more things along those lines. So that's why I ended up connecting with you in the first place. So it's always
on the big screen, then all the stuff is just going to blow away. It's going to be like sand just eroding and blowing away. And I think really the public, they're looking for heroes, and they're realizing that a lot of the people that they're looking to for that is shallow, it's hollow. These are the real heroes that are willing to lay down their life for the people they don't even know, but because their nation called and they answered it. So I appreciate very much what you're doing as well.
That's good that we got in touch with each other for this. We're on the same wavelength for sure. Now,
absolutely.
As far as the actual band goes, who else besides Gary Sinise is involved with the whole production of the band?
Well, he's got an incredible band. It's a 12-piece band, and I got to tell you, it's funny. It's funny else when a buddy of yours comes up and goes, "Hey, I got a band coming. Come guys jam, we're playing them such and such." I'm like, wow, I hope they don't stink. You don't want to have to think. And then you show up, and it's, again, it's a 12-piece band, and these guys rock it out. They're all professionals. Most of them are out of Chicago. Some live in a couple other places. But two or three times a month, or more often sometimes, they'll all fly to wherever that event is. And I tell these guys in front of this church, speaking at thousands of people, and as many as 14,000 people. And they're a cover band. And obviously, they do that because they want to play songs that everybody knows and recognizes. They can sing and jam along with them. And it gives them an escape for 2.5 to 3 hours. And it's a long show, and they're just nonstop when they are jamming band. And it's just been really incredible. So, you know, a lot of these guys for years, and as the band is like this, there's a little bit of turnover. There hasn't really been much of that in the 4 years that I've known. In fact, only one person. And they are from all spectrums as far as their political outlook or their values outlook. But the one thing that they're all about that's supporting and providing entertainment and a little bit of escapism for our troops. And it's also one thing we really wanted to make sure we bent over backwards with the movie is we avoid all politics altogether. And we've got a great line from Robert Duvall saying, basically, when you're for the war, against the war, whatever your political leanings might be, that's irrelevant. It's about supporting our men and women to do the one. And that's one thing that we want to make sure stays clear.
Yeah, I actually noticed the difference between the Vietnam era and these days. The majority of Americans out there, I think, would say the same thing, that regardless of your politics, you should still support the troops. And I think it's encouraging to see that change in the spectrum. And as far as the actual work of doing the filming and production and all that, what did you enjoy most about the actual work itself to put this all together?
The trips and meeting all the people. You know, not only meeting the people that we met when we were on location, but then also the people that we've been able to screen the movie for. We were able to screen it for President Bush 41 at his library at Texas A&M, USO, General Campbell at Fort Campbell for the 101st Airborne, General Mulholland, the Special Forces, Colonel Clay Hutmacher with the 160th SOAR group, you know, which is the Black Hawk guys. And just the guy that you would never know their names, but they're missing a body part where they've paid a huge price. And you look into their eyes and hear them say, right away, I wouldn't change a thing. I would do it all over again. And you see people of real significance, even though people may never know their names. And I was mentioning earlier, my life is so much richer now because of the people I've been able to meet. And I'm inspired by it. And an example is going to Walter Reed in the middle of Babylon out here in California. When you go and visit some of these wounded guys, hoping that maybe you might be able to make a little bit of a difference and pick them up or something, they completely turn the tables on you every time. Next thing you know, you're standing taller, you're feeling more proud. And I just salute these guys. And I have to say that's the most rewarding thing that we've all been able to meet during this journey.
And what is the sense you get from a lot of the military folks about ending these conflicts? Is there a sense that these guys all want to come home, or are they just pretty much to be called
also enlisted knowing, but we're at war. And when you're enlisting, and it used to be, if it was just a Marine or Army, you know, for a fact you're going, well, also the Air Force is going over there, the Coast Guard is over there, and some of these guys are on, you know, multiple deployments now. Majority of the deployments after a certain number are volunteer. And, yeah, they want to come home, but they also know that they've got a job to do, and they're big up. Let me say it this way, too. They don't want to come home before the job is done. So all of these days you're thrown about, and we're going to be out by such a time, most of the guys don't care for that. They go, if we leave by a calendar date, then what are we over here for? We leave when we win.
And does it seem like they are getting to that point where they're seeing those results, that they are winning? I notice, obviously, that the widespread revolution going on in the Middle East. Do you think, personally, do you think that's a result of what we've done over there? And do you see the troops showing that sentiment at all?
What do you mean as far as what else is happening in the Middle East?
Right, with like Syria and Libya and even Yemen, they're having civil war. You know, just this morning I heard the president of Yemen was wounded when they attacked the palace. So it seems like people are rising up all across the Middle East. And you don't unfortunately hear too much in the press about, you know, what's causing that, whether it's, you know, what we've done over there to spread democracy or just that the people don't have enough. But I think it's, personally, I think it's got a lot to do with what the troops are doing. But I'm just curious as to what you've seen as far as, you know, soldiers that you've talked to and shown the movie to. They've been talking about that and what you think about it.
You know, it's really, again, these guys will go where they're asked to go. And in uniform, they're not going to speak against the policies of the administration or anything like that, because regardless of what they may feel about the president, he's still the commander in chief, and they're going to do what they're asked to do or told to do. One thing that we certainly know is that we live in very precarious times. I mean, it's really fragile over here. They make it very clear that they hate America because it's just who we are, or they hate Israel because Israel exists. And, you know, we've got to have people in uniform that are willing to do the tough part, to have a list, and that's what these guys do.
All right. And going back to the band itself, what's their greatest strength, would you say? And what does Garrison bring to the whole picture? Or is he just one of the biggest faces? You know, how does he carry himself with the band?
Well, the real strength of the band is they know why they're there. going to launch July 4th at LTGambleandMovie.com, where $1 out of $34 will go back to organizations that support the troops, the military, the Vicarious Cities Foundation. And then after that month, we'll have a DVD release. That's all being finalized right now. But it should be pretty widespread and very available.
What would you say is the best part about knowing Gary himself and working with him as a partner on this?
One of the things I have to say about Gary, he's just a down-to-earth guy. You know, there's not that celebrity feeling or attitude in any way. And this is a guy who truly hurts when he hears somebody else getting hurt or getting killed. He comes from a military family. You know, his father, grandfather, uncle served, his brother-in-law, his sister-in-law. He really understands and gets what he gives. And Dale Dye is also a good friend of ours, Captain Dale Dye. He just basically says, there's this cliche that freedom is free, but we really get that. And there's a substantial amount of people that also get that. And they realize that
FNU.mypodcast.com anytime, and it's the second podcast down right now. It's Jonathan Flora. So thanks for listening, and until next week. Adios.